My name is Alexis Gore. I am 22 years old, and I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan, where I majored in chemistry. My home address is 3429 Christine, Lansing, Michigan, 48911.
Let's begin with something simple, but just give me a description of a physical description of where you grew up.
I grew up in a Midwestern town, about 120,000, pretty good size for Michigan. What's the fourth largest city in Michigan? It's basically a blue-collar town, but it does have the state government, and there is Michigan State University across the way. My parents, my mom was a teacher. My dad is a frustrated engineer. He got laid off in Boeing, but now he works for the state. I grew up in probably a typical middle-class background. I lived across the street from this place. I can see the house right now where I grew up, one-story, brown brick. Had a pool in the back, which is really nice as a kid. Got me a lot of friends. The town itself is a really nice town to grow up in. I remember reading the Book of Lists where it was number 7 one year back in 75. But overall, I liked it. It's a quiet town. I think it was better than growing up in a rural area, whereas there's more to do here. And it's better than growing up in, say, a big city, because I got to enjoy some of the things like mowing the grass or going to football games, something like a friend of mine who grew up in New York City didn't. Overall, I've enjoyed it. It's a nice place.
Can you talk a little bit about the high school that you attended, your general feelings about it, whether it was a challenge, whether you were bored?
I went to J.W. Sexton. It's, I don't know if you call it inner city, but it's 30 to 40% racially mixed. But surprisingly enough, I never felt any racial tensions when I was there. In fact, I really enjoyed going to the school. As far as challenging, it wasn't challenging at all, I think. Education today teaches to teach at the middle level. And I don't mean to boost myself up or anything, but I mean, I'm above that. And I mean, since they taught at that level, I didn't find it really challenging at all. There were maybe one or two classes like English literature, which I hate, which I found hard because I didn't like the poetry too much. But overall, it wasn't very challenging. I mean, it gives you a good education, but it really doesn't stimulate the brighter kids because they're just stagnating. Like physics, for example. I mean, Sexton always bragged that we have 8 classes of physics at Sexton, but it's physics for the masses. I mean, it's on such a basic level that I mean, it took me maybe 10 minutes to comprehend the whole lesson. And at the end of the marking period, I always had 106% of the total possible points. Where I mean, it was nothing. I would go in there and get my homework done. That wasn't challenging at all, I thought. But you can't blame a district for that because they do have to teach to the middle level.
Shouldn't there be special classes or something for the more gifted?
There should be, and there are in a sense. But the problem is there is you got. I mean, you probably know the atypical parent who thinks their child is just a genius, right? And oh, I hear advanced class. My son, he's a genius. He has to be in there. And most of the time, that tends to, what I've found, to dilute the class. And you can't really get the bright kids in there, because first of all, you're the bright kids. Then you have the parents who dilute it. Then you have to have a certain number of you have to get your minority quota in there. And as bad as that sounds, it's the truth. You know, I mean, it's prevalent throughout the whole society today. I mean, you really can't get a gifted, a class of truly gifted students in the school district. But you can give a better level class. Like they have AP classes and advanced courses, which are better than the normal, but still those fail to stimulate me as well.
Well, are we putting out then generation after generation of kids who are really not very well educated? If we are only catering to this middle level of student, and we're really producing a high percentage of gifted kids who have never been challenged. By the time they're not challenged until they're 19 or 20 when they go to college. Is that accurate?
I really don't. If it's accurate, I don't know. I'm just drawing from my own perspective. Granted, I mean, there are always going to be those few bright kids who are going to slip through the cracks and not feel challenged at all. But in my case, I'm a very motivated individual, and I tend to challenge myself and whatnot. But as far as, I think the school district gives you, I mean, they give you, or at least they offer you, a good education. And it's up to you to take advantage of it. And in some instances, they do push you for it, but they can only push so much. I mean, they can't sit there and say, force feed you an education and force you to accept it. a lot of it has to do with the socioeconomic background which you were brought up in. And I was brought up by two, you know, people who really value education, my mother and my father. So it was just ingrained in me that I needed a good education, or a will or desire to get knowledge was just given to me. I still have it. But to say that it's the fault of the school systems, I wouldn't say that.
So you trace it perhaps more to the inspiration which may or may not come from the family.
Exactly. I think that has a lot to do with how you view an education. I mean, it's probably the biggest turning point. I mean, if you grew up in a family who doesn't value education as opposed to one who does, I mean, I think immediately you will be able to see a big difference in the student. I'm not saying that's the case all the time, but for quite a bit of it, it is.
So from the time you were very young, there was a lot of emphasis placed on education.
Extreme emphasis.
Were you forced to, can you describe the things which your mother and father did they force your nose to the grindstone? Did they say, look, you go into that room for 5 hours and you do those until those lessons are done to our satisfaction, or what?
The funny thing is, my parents never, ever told me to do my homework. I always did it on my own. I think the force came when I was little. My father, he was assistant professor or something along those lines at Michigan State. And when we first moved to Lansing, we'd always, every Sunday, he'd take all the kids and we'd go to the MS Museum. We run on the track and just we'd hang around in the university, and he'd always, always, always tell us about how, you know, he always got straight A's in college, how about my mother always got straight A's in college, how he always got straight A's, how it's very important to do this. And as I found out later in life, it was a lie. My parents never got straight A's. They were bright one night, but they never got straight A's. I was very furious when I found this out, because I had this thing ingrained in my mind that if I don't get straight A's in anything, I'll fail.
Now, did this have the same effect on your siblings?
My sister does well. She does as well as I do in school. But whether or not she has the same attitude towards it, I think she does. She might not admit it as readily as I will, but I think she does. But my brother, no, I don't want to say something went wrong with him. He's just sort of looking for something to do in life right now. Of course, he's only 20 years old, and I can't blame him. I mean, to send him to college would be a waste of money. And the important thing is, I think that he realizes that as well as my parents. So he's just looking around for something to do right now. Hopefully he'll go to college later.
Is this sort of the classic problem of the younger brother being overshadowed by his star older brother and star older sister?
I do. I think it is. And to a certain extent it is. Even though my mom never showed any favoritism toward anyone. If she showed anything, it was toward my younger brother. I think maybe that was possibly to compensate for how well we did. My parents have never, ever pushed grades on us. But my sister and I, she never had to do it on my sister and myself because we did well. But for my brother, once in a while he'd get a D in something and she wouldn't yell at him or anything. She never, ever made any of us do our homework. Or like told us, go in your room and do your homework. I mean, she just maybe would gently nudge us. My mother or my father to some extent, they were never the kind of pushy parents. We were always almost given a free rein in anything we did.
All right, and at Sexton you had one perception of your intelligence, which is based on your comparing yourself to a rather large group of students who weren't as motivated as you are, and in many cases were not as bright. When you went to college, you had to revamp, I would suggest, or guess, your perception of your intelligence level, how you were going to fit into the world.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about how that perception changed from high school to college, how you adapted, what you went through in that first year, as you were suddenly inundated by 200 people in a class, and there were at least 30 in there who were as gifted as you were?
I remember walking in the South Quad for the first time, and on the doors they'd have the names of the occupants there. And I'd look at my name, and I'd see like Mark Mays and Mike App, and God, those guys are probably geniuses. And I look across the hall, and I see three other names. I go, God, they're probably geniuses too. And I would walk around and I felt stupid at that place, because first of all, it's a brand new environment. I had no clue what was going on. I had no idea of what was expected of me or how I would do. So I had this massive inferiority complex when I first went to the University of Michigan, just because, you know, it's the University of Michigan, wow, everyone's bright, and people there are much brighter. I mean, they're more educated, they're articulate. I mean, they like to argue a lot about things, about issues, and I liked that in the beginning. But as time wore on, I realized that, you know, I did fit in there, that, you know, maybe I wasn't the top of the hill like I was at Sexton, but I was near it. And
near the top of the hill. What you majored in?
Chemistry.
Chemistry. And what was your grade point average?
Overall, 3.9.
3.9.
Right.
I would say that was rather close to the top of the hill.
Yeah. I was, frankly, I didn't think I'd ever do that well in college. I mean, I was ready to accept like something less than a 4 point, like I had gotten in high school. And I got my first B in my life my first semester there in history class, and that was just a huge shock to me. It had to happen sometime.
Why was it a shock?
Because, I mean, it was the first, I worked my ass off in that class. I mean, because I knew I wasn't going to, I mean, I knew I was faltering, and a TA didn't like me. Maybe it was just my perception of what was going on. I didn't like the TA either. She's what I call a militant feminist, but that's beside the point. And I worked very hard. I've worked extremely hard in that class, and I didn't get an A. I've always worked very hard on things to get A's.
Have you analyzed your motivation for working so hard in that class?
Pardon me?
What was your real motivation for working so hard
in
that
class?
To get an A.
To get an A.
Do you think that, can you evaluate that motivation? I mean, there are reasons for taking classes.
Okay.
Some reasons are to maintain a high grade point average. Other reasons are simply to learn one aspect of a subject because that subject interests you. In other words, you conceivably could have taken many courses
right.
where you would have run the risk of not getting an A at all. So what is primary here? Is the grade point average or is it the knowledge?
It's the knowledge. But it is the knowledge. I took that course. It was a sophomore class, but I took it as a freshman because it was a History 201, History of Ancient Greece. And I went to Michigan as a history philosophy major. And I like history, I still do, and I like the subject matter. And I really do like to learn things. I do like knowledge. And so I never have ever taken a class as a grade point boost or anything. I took it because I wanted to take this, I want to know more about this subject. So I really don't look at taking a class. When it comes time to evaluate my motivation for the class, it's not necessarily how much I like the material, because, I mean, I'm not going to take a class that I don't like.
It is how much you like the material. That's the basis for taking the class.
Right, that's the basis for taking the class, but my basis for the motivation of how I do in there is just strictly to, I mean, if I take this class, I got to get an A.
Yeah, so once you say, I like this course, then you commit yourself to working hard and getting the highest possible grade.
Right.
You're very competitive.
Extremely. It was, like I said, it was ingrained in me as a kid. It was just, I can't explain where, but I know it is. Probably me too, but my father's competitive as well.
Yeah, interesting. When did you know that you wanted to major in chemistry? And would you go into a little bit about what branch of chemistry that turned out to be, et cetera?
I remember during my freshman year, I was taking this freshman lab class, and this professor came in, and I had done well enough in the lecture class to be invited into the honors section the next term, and he asked me if I was going to join it. I said, no, I'm going to be a history philosophy major. I said, proudly. Then he came back a couple weeks later, and I said, sure, why not? I'll take it. I enjoy chemistry. And so I went into it, and it was basically a big lab class. It was home lecture, and we did a lot of titrations, a lot of analysis, chemical analysis on percentages of such and such and such and such. And it was a lot of work. I mean, I spent a lot. I mean, the lab write-ups were like, you know, 5-6 hours a piece. I don't know, I must be a say or something, but I really enjoyed the lab write-ups. I really enjoyed the lab, and I really liked the material.
You mean a masochist?
A masochist. I always get those two mixed up. But a masochist, exactly. But I really enjoyed it, and I started thinking about chemistry. Because realistically, my father's an engineer, my mother's a social scientist. Never really liked my father. My mom's one of my idols. And to want to grow up to be an engineer, I felt as though I was somehow betraying my mother. And so I went into college, a history philosophy major, somewhat to please my mother and at the same time piss off my father. Because I remember he was just incensed that I wasn't going to be an engineer, that I was not going to be an engineer. And in high school, I always loved chemistry. In fact, it was probably my favorite class. But I went in there saying, I'll be a history philosophy major. I have to be a social scientist. You know, I do not want to be an engineer because I don't want to be like my father. But initially, and the first term of college, there was always that fight between history, philosophy, and like science, because I've always liked science. I always did really well in it, and I did well in history, philosophy. And I liked it, but not as much as I liked science. And finally, during my second term freshman year, that finally came to a head, and I said, it is ridiculous to do something. It is ridiculous in life not to do something that you don't really like.
In spite of what
I want to do.
Vendettas you may have against what parents.
And I should leave that behind, just get it over with. And just put it behind me and being immature about it. And so I finally said, I want to major in chemistry. And initially I wanted to be an analytical chemist because that's what the class was in. But the next term I took organic chemistry. And that, I loved it. I mean, most people have organic chemistry. I hate it, but the structures, the mechanisms involved, it's actually beauty. In fact, there's this one book called Art in Organic Synthesis, and it is. It's an art. I mean, the structures of things and just the way they combine and the structures, and it's beautiful. I mean, you should see it sometimes. I mean, I took like 2 years of it. I worked for a professor. I did research in synthetic organic chemistry. It turned out well. I mean, I got a lot of good experience in it, and I loved it. I mean, I don't.
Where is all this going to lead in terms of, if you can restrict your answer to what you would like to do with chemistry?
Initially, I mean, even back then, I knew I wanted to be a professor at a university. And so, I've always wanted to go and get my PhD, and I was getting my PhD in chemistry, and just settle down in some probably small university, do some research, and just teach.
Similar to this environment in this town, you mean? Not necessarily this town, but
yes.
Yeah.
Live maybe in East Lansing, you know, something like that.
Teach. Rather than conducting your own research.
Well, I teach and do research, but
is there a focus there? Which do you prefer?
Personally, I'd rather do research, but I have an inferiority complex. I don't think I have what it takes to do it. I mean, I just look at my professor who I did research for, and he was just so. I mean, he was just brilliant, and I looked at him, I'm going, how could I ever be like this man? I mean, his ideas, he would just sit there and just rattle off this chemical reaction and look at this new idea, and you just look at it and you go, wow, that's great, you're right. And then I'd sit there, and like 10 minutes later, I'd sit back, I'd look at it, and I'd go, there's no way in my life I would ever have thought of that. I don't, you know, but, and so the emphasis would be I'd really like to research, and if I could do it, I will, but I think realistically, I'd probably be a better teacher.
It's interesting because you say that when you first went to U of M, you were stricken with a kind of inferiority complex, which is typical. A lot of freshmen are suddenly submerged by a high level of intelligence surrounding them. But you're also saying that even when you had done well with a number of courses, you were in awe of this professor. So again, it's this inferiority. I mean, one possible answer you could have given me might have been the man had 40 more years in the field than I had.
That's true, he did.
And why shouldn't he do that? And
that's what he's been doing his entire life. I mean, his entire life has been focused on this type of research. I mean, he's read all the literature. I mean, he's done some of the novel work in it. You know, why shouldn't he? But still, I had this feeling. I don't like doing things where I'm not adept at it because I have to do everything well. And if I don't do things well, and if I start out somewhat bumbling, it bothers me.
Won't that prevent you from conducting certain kinds of explorations within the field? If you feel that you never know when you're in new territory how well you're going to do.
Exactly.
And you may bumble along and stumble for 5 years, particularly in the field of research. You may be barking up all sorts of blind alleys.
Right.
Blind, that's a mixed metaphor, isn't it? Barking up wrong trees, I should say. But you're really saying that you have to have something more tangible and concrete to hold on to. That you must be aware of some rather high level of competence from the beginning, otherwise you lose heart and don't want to continue. That's what I hear you saying to me. Now, does that attitude to me doesn't really fit into what a researcher should have, which is an ability to go forward and to stumble and not feel bad about the stumbling, because that's part and parcel of all research. Well, I'm babbling on here, but you see the point I'm making?
I see the point you're making, and the research I was doing, I did research for about 18 months, and truthfully, for about the first 12 months, I felt useless. What I was trying to do just wasn't working, and I was barking up the wrong tree, but I still worked hard at it, and eventually it worked, but that was with my professor prodding me along, oh, it'll work. But I see what you're saying, and personally, I don't want to agree with it. I don't think I agree with it. But that's something that I can only think can be evaluated when I'm put in that situation. If I'm given the opportunity to do research, I will do it. I mean, given I have my PhD, maybe when I have my PhD, because, you know, I'm just an undergraduate in the realm of graduate students and professors. I mean, I feel like, I don't know, and the truth, I really don't know what's going on. But if you maybe were to thrust me in a situation where I had a PhD, I had read the literature and what's going on, I knew what more was going on, where I had a little more confidence in myself, then maybe I would assert myself in the research field. But, you know, I have never been placed in that situation. I've only been an undergrad. And if you know what that means, undergrad in a big research level university isn't much of anything.
How about your fellow graduate or your fellow students? Were there some bright ones in your
Sure.
particular field?
Mm-hmm. I worked with two. Well, I worked with one and I knew another one. And they're both going to University of California at Berkeley now. And
did you feel that you were on the same level with them? Mm-hmm. Same level. You didn't feel superior to them?
Or? I couldn't say that about those people. They were bright. I mean, to say that I would be in error.
Mm-hmm.
I would not be justified in saying that.
These weren't the lower echelon students of Sexton.
No, they didn't go to Sexton. No, they didn't go to Sexton. I know
that's a bad joke. Well, you seem to have a remarkable understanding of the direction that you took and why you took it, and you seem clear about why you rejected the notion, certain notions. How can I phrase this? There's no point. What I'm trying to say is that even though you knew at the time that when you were younger that your father had a certain influence, you were able to evaluate it and then proceed in a direction which was really similar to the direction that he took, in the sense that both of you were in technical fields.
Right.
And there are a lot of people who don't figure that out until they're much older. They may discover at the age of 40 or 45 that they've been following a certain path because it was despite a parent.
Well, mine was put basically in plain English. I remember when I was applying I applied to Kalamazoo College initially, which is a small liberal arts school, and they had no engineering school. And my father was I remember being absolutely infuriated at it. You know, why do you want to go here? There's no engineering school here. Blah 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 blah. And it was just understood that I was going to grow up and be an engineer. Because I mean, my father was born in India, and in India, the first son does whatever the father says, and you know, it's just natural that I would want to follow his footsteps in the engineering field. And plus, at the time, and still to this day, I mean, everybody in my high school wanted to be an engineer. What do you want to do? Well, I want to go to MSU and major in engineering. I would even be an engineer. Everyone wants to be an engineer. Really, there are very few engineers in this world, but everyone wants to be one. And that sense, you know, it was just accepted that I was going to be an engineer. And I personally never really wanted to be an engineer. I still don't want to be an engineer. I'm happy in chemistry. It's a technical field, yes. Whether or not I followed my father in there, because my father was a technical person, I don't know. I just had a gift for it in high school. I found that I had a gift for it in college.
Why did you take the particular route that you do? Was it simply economic? That is, getting the funding through the Navy and so forth to continue with your schooling. Could you describe how you got that funding and so forth?
Why I joined the Navy?
How they factored into your continued education at U of M and so forth?
They didn't really. Okay, I'm sure you understand.
Go back to the beginning. Did you apply for a grant or what? Or
no, as far as the Navy goes, if you were to ask me my freshman year if you told me I was going to be in the Navy by the end of my junior year, I'd probably laugh in your face. I was anti-military almost. And most of my friends to this day can't believe it. They're shocked that a liberal gore is in the military. But I have found that while I'm in college, I am actually a closet conservative. But my mom says I have raised a conservative who can't vote Republican, because I can't really bring myself to vote Republican. But anyway, you know my mom.
That's funny.
Why I joined the Navy? At the time where I did join the Navy, my parents were recently divorced, and there were assurances on both sides that my education would be provided for until I finished, because, you know, I can't afford to go to UVM. I'm just being a student, having no job, having no savings. And it was assured by both sides that my mom said I'll provide half, my father said he will provide half. And they were providing two halves because my sister was there at the same time. And initially it worked out very fine, no problem with the money. Then second term things got hairy. My father just stopped paying. He just all out. You know, I said, Dad, you know, I'm gonna have to quit school, and he was just so, I don't, you know, he didn't care, you know. He's strange. But even before this, I got this thing from the Navy, and I showed interest in it. It said $1,200 a month, blah, blah, blah. I looked at it, great. I put it on the back of my burners. And then that, my parents being divorced and being in a money crunch, I mean, I could have gotten through my junior year, no problem. But getting through my senior year was a different question. I might be able to work, but I needed some money somewhere, and I looked at the Navy, because they promised a certain stipend a month that I could do with it whatever I pleased. You know, $1,200 a month, didn't have to go for school. I could have bought a car or whatever. Which, anyways. And so I talked to the recruiter, and my recruiter, strangely enough, was a real nice guy. I'm sure everyone has this preconceived notion of what a military recruiter is. This guy just keeps pestering you, blah, 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 blah. And I don't lie to you to get you in there. But I had this Brian McKercher. He's a great guy, and if I had anyone different, even the one I work with now, I probably wouldn't be in it because I didn't trust him initially. But Brian was great. He really helped me. I really trusted the man, and he really gave me the straight facts about what the Navy is like. He said, you know, you're probably not gonna like this, but this is the way it is. You're not gonna like this, but this is the way it is. You know, granted there are all these benefits, but this is the way it is. And I said, you're right. And I went on this like VIP trip to Charleston, South Carolina. I went on a sub, went on a ship. And I really enjoyed it. I liked it. And I just decided that I'd join.
Now that I know that you've been exposed to a lot of your mother's thinking, which tends to be quite rebellious, depending upon the subject. She's certainly not a conformist. And does she think that you've sold out to the establishment in some way? Does she just kid you about this, or does she now approve of it?
My mother does not. I don't say she doesn't approve it. She my mother accepts it. She doesn't like it. She thinks I should be an academician, researching for the rest of my life, because that's what, you know, she wanted to do as a child, and that's what she wants to see us do. But she accepts it. Whether I sold to the establishment, I really don't know if she ever felt that way. I know at times I felt like I did that. I sold myself just to get money. I mean, to say I didn't join for the money would be a lie. But there was something else, I think.
Would you have done this 20 years ago at the time in the Vietnam War, where you might have been thrust into combat off the shores of Vietnam?
Probably not. It's not. I mean, threat of combat. Whereas now it might not... Now it's point smooth. I'm in. I can't do anything about it, but... If I had that looming over me as to join going in, I honestly don't think I would have joined. You know, I mean, take that as cowardly. You know, I don't know what. I mean, I don't want to die. You know.
Well, aside from the cowardice, which may or may not be involved, there is also the whole issue of whether whether you believed in the war. And in hindsight, there are an awful lot of people who look back now and say that the cause was lost from the beginning. There are others who say the opposite, but I think there are more in the former camp. Are you capable of looking at a particular political situation and saying, I would or would not be a member of the military because I would choose to support or not to support military action in a certain part of the world? By joining the Navy at a certain time, you would have ended up in Vietnam. It's almost inevitable. By joining the infantry, you most certainly would have ended up in Vietnam if you'd joined the infantry back in the 1960s or the Marines or whatever. But you might have at that point have conscientiously objected and said, this war it doesn't make any sense, the congressmen are wrong, I'm not going to go for that reason. Aside from the issue of being or not being a coward, I'm talking about the whole political ramifications. Will you take a political stand if push comes to shove?
No.
Suppose.
No. Personally, I hate politics, and I I politics are everywhere. I mean, you see even the smallest levels of life, there's always politics going on, and watching it. I'd like to think of myself above politics, but in reality, no one is above politics in this society. But I've come to the fact, if my superior told me to do something, whether I liked it or not, I'll do it. That's my job. That's what I joined.
Don't you draw the line somewhere?
Nope. If I was on, I've gotten in many argument over this at U of M, and if I were on a ballistic missile submarine, and I was given the order to fire my missiles, my 24 ICBMs, I believe, and I firmly believe that I would do it. I would do it. I would have no hesitations in turning the key and pressing the button.
That's interesting. That's only one of many situations that you could hypothesize.
I think that's the biggest. I mean, that's...
But that's certainly a big one, but...
That's the one at the end all, I think. I mean,
if you, at the time, had been conversing with what was going on in the world, knew the political situation, and believed that you were in the hands of a madman who was ordering the launching of these missiles...
I see what you're
would
saying.
Would you still do it?
Dr. Strangelove.
Now, hold it. There was a Dr. Strangelove in reality. Adolf Hitler. You might have been German. You might have been in the German Navy in the 1930s.
Maybe I was, but...
You might have been a member of the German General Staff.
Who knows? But, you know, maybe I would have been swept along in the political rhetoric that he spewed out, and I believed in the cause. What you're giving me is a realistic scenario, that I do have a madman. My decision to press the button on the boomer was based on I have a sane leader behind me. You know, that I trust his decision, but to say
can that ever be the premise? Can you ever assume that?
Why not? You can have any premise you want, can't you?
At what point do you consider you should act responsibly as someone who should know more about the political scene so that you can make a decision as to participate in the military? Or do you blindly say, my country right or wrong, but my country, the hell with what the president thinks, I'll just follow orders?
You give me two extreme situations there. I mean, and to choose either one is wrong, obviously. I mean, you should. There's always a mix in reality between, you know, the two extremes. But where you should draw the line got me worried. I'm not saying, I don't know where the line should be drawn, but it should be drawn somewhere. Obviously, if things get out of hand, obviously, if you're not the only one, if everyone you talk to in little secret goes, da-da, this guy's crazy, da-da-da. And, I mean, if you yourself really believe it and you're sure of it, and, I mean... It depends on the person's convictions. If you have convictions in it yourself and you can't do it, then that's where you should draw the line. How far I'll go, I'll never know until I'm actually put in that situation.
Are you saying that ultimately your philosophy depends upon your own self-consciousness, that what you must obey ultimately is your sense of belief?
Ultimately, yes.
This goes beyond any command, any... order which may come from
right.
Online.
No one has to do anything in the world. They never have to do anything. It's ridiculous. I have to do this. No, you don't have to do it. But you have to face the consequences of your actions. And if you're prepared to face the consequences of your actions and live with yourself, then that's fine. But you never have to do anything.
I agree with that. I think there are a lot of people in the military who would not agree with that, though. They would tend to lean more towards my country, right or wrong, but my
obviously
country.
They should. I mean, I'm a very loyal person. I will follow my orders. I mean, to what extent I do not know. I have to come to the situation, but I do believe in chain of command and should. Oh, I mean, even when I was put in the fake, you know, environment of officer candidate school. I mean, my superiors were giving me stupid orders, but they were just stupid little orders, and I just followed. No matter how much I hated them, I did them. But it didn't matter to the amount of like pressing the button on a boomer or anything.
Do you think the basic philosophy of a boot camp and other similar programs in the military of subduing the individual totally in the beginning, is that the appropriate one? The concept of instant and unquestioned obedience, is this what should be done in places like boot camp?
Got to do it sometime in the military. Else do it in the beginning. You can't. That's not, see something like that just can't be. You just can't hand feed that to somebody. You have to sit there and you have to shock it into a person, because that way you're immediately gonna get rid of the ones that can't handle it. They can't handle it. They're gonna get out right away, and it's slowly it's gonna wear away at everyone, to the point where it just sort of weeds out people. And that's what, in a sense, that's what you need in the military. I mean, at boot camp, they teach you an extreme of utter blind obedience, because that's what, idealistically, theoretically, one should be in the military. But as we were talking before, obviously, there are some situations where your conscience might override that, but they need to teach that in the military. Without total obedience, it's not much of anything. It's not a military organization.
You're talking about a chain of command which should exist to control most of the people in the military, aren't you? I mean, if you talk about the most significant military leaders in history, these are the ones who have not followed the norm. They broke the conventions even within the military. People like Hyman Rickover, who was talking about a nuclear-powered submarine before it was popular to do so. Billy Mitchell, who talked about the need for an Air Force, right, whenever he said it'll never be solved by the Air Force, the horses will do it, or, you know, the artillery will do it.
But you see, it's so easy to seem like such a radical in the military, because once you get this huge build up of all these old traditionalists, you get somebody comes along with what seems like a radical idea, whereas when we look back in hindsight, it's just natural evolution of an idea. I mean, you get all these people who thought in the Navy the battleships are God, nothing will ever be better than the battleship, okay? Then you got this one crazy person who thinks the carrier. Look at the carrier. And he's like, oh, you're just complete radical. You have no clue what you're talking about. Now it's to the point where we have people think carriers are the end all. And if you read the military journals, there's a starting dissent. Is why do we need carriers? They're so vulnerable in a nuclear scenario. So whereas you might think that those people were so radical and so different, unconventional, you have to look at what they were going up against. I mean, total tradition. I mean, and once you go in the face of total and utter tradition, anything is radical.
So how does anyone retain his individuality in the military for very long? It erodes away your individuality, doesn't it?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I've only been in the real Navy for about 4 months now. But there, I mean, you can be an individual in the Navy. I mean, when it comes time to go to work, I mean, there's a different time between at work in the military. And I mean, there's time alone, and you can do certain things that are different. I mean, I don't think the military does allow time to be yourself. And it's, I mean, maybe when I go on my sub for 3 months underwater, I won't have any time to be myself. But when I get out on the sub and go out and have some time to myself, I will. But I think it's based on the individual. I mean, how pliable are they to certain situations? I mean, if they're just forced, I mean, if they themselves conform to be the utter obedience person, then that's that individual's fate. It's karma, you know.
But in terms of your particular interest, which happens to be chemistry, and ultimately, from what you said earlier,
ultimately,
an interest in
teaching.
Research, teaching, is there opportunity in the Navy to do that to the same degree that there might be if you did this at a university?
No, it doesn't exist. I don't think so. I highly doubt it. I'd like it to be, but I don't think so. In 5 years, I'm going to make a decision whether I want to stay in or go to grad school for chemistry. And I can't make the decision right now because I really have no idea what it's like in the Navy. If I like the Navy, my chance of command of my own boat in the sub is pretty good in the sub community. And if I like it, I'll probably stay in, but that's 5 years down the road. But, I mean, there's always this itch to go back to grad school, get my PhD, which is always there.
How much of, how important is the ego trip here of having a command, having your own ship, telling people what to do, where you are the top gun?
One of the last places in the world where you are God, a sense, a God of what, I mean, when you're on your boat out at sea by yourself and you're the captain of that ship, you are unquestioned. I mean, whatever what you do at that point, that time, is right. I mean, they have to follow you. It is like the last ultimate power trip you can get in this world. And
how does that fit into your mentality?
I like it. I mean, I was a battalion commander at OCS. I was in charge of about 120 people, and one of my peer evals. Somebody
one
called
of your what?
Peer evals, peer evaluations. My
oh,
peers
evaluation. Peer evaluation.
I'm sorry, I call them peer evals.
Don't know these Navy terms.
My peer evaluation. Somebody actually described me, honestly, as a little Hitler, and that obviously took me by surprise. My mom looked at me and she said, I told her about that. And she goes, that really doesn't surprise me too much because you always enjoyed positions of authority and power over people. And I guess when I am in those positions, I do. I mean, I like it. I don't think I abuse it. Obviously, somebody thought I must have since they called me a little Hitler.
You don't have trouble telling people what to do?
No, not when, I mean, no, I don't. I don't think I tell them to do crazy, outlandish things. I mean, I like to be in control of things, working towards a goal and getting it accomplished as best as possible.
Well, that thrill of having a command at that level, battalion commander, and ultimately the possibility of having a command on a ship, that pumps a lot of adrenaline through your system.
Right. You get worked up over it.
Now, when you step back 3 feet and look at yourself as a person who is pumped up by that kind of situation, and you compare it to Lexi, the man in the lab who's doing research and with maybe two or three other brilliant professors, which comes out on top? Where does the adrenaline pump a little harder?
Oh, command. I remember one time when I was doing chemical research, I finally got this one thing to work, and I was just pumped up. I was jumping up and down for joy. But when you compare it to a command, it's command.
Have you answered the question, then, of what you will do?
Maybe. I don't know. Like I said,
it sure sounds like
it. It sounds like it. It sounds like, yeah, this guy's going to stay there for the rest of his life, and maybe I will. But I've never been on a sub before. I've never been out at sea for 3 months. Yeah. I don't know whether I like it or not. Chances are, if I like it, I'll stay in. If I don't like it, obviously I'll get out. It's too early to tell, I think.
I can't make a judgment based on a half an hour discussion with you. But based on what you've said so far, I would conclude in about 30 seconds that there's no reason you won't like it.
Maybe. Don't tell my mom that. She doesn't want me to stay.
And I hope you not think that I'm laying a judgment on you, because I don't. If you want to do that, fine. That's wonderful. I mean, I don't care whether you end up in the research lab or a nuclear sub. I don't have any moral convictions which say you're selling out. You should be in the lab of a noble university,
yeah,
University
this
of California.
This has all gone through my mind about a million times at night.
So you wrestle. Everyone has a basic dichotomy or conflict, if he's the least bit intelligent. Some people have no conflicts. They just contemplate their navels all the time.
Right.
But and yours seems to be one of the conscience, where you're wrestling with these two sides. There is the adrenaline that goes pumping through your system when you have a command, in which you certainly will experience to the ultimate degree, as you've already described, if you ever are fortunate enough to get a command on a sub or what a similar ship or whatever. And then on the other hand, though, is whether there might be something more important in life than simply getting your jollies by being a commander in the Navy.
Yeah, there's always the possibility of getting this newfound knowledge that'll save mankind in the research lab and further progressing man's knowledge, no matter how remote it is. Because today in research, I mean, we're so specialized these days. Everything's so damn remote.
But you've described yourself as a person who wants to progress with a degree of confidence, where you need to go from point A to B to C to D and to feel a sense of clear achievement. You don't want to be fumbling around too much.
Right.
And research can involve years of that.
Don't tell me about it. I know that.
Yeah?
And
so how can there be a choice?
I don't know.
It seems to me that there is no choice here. That
maybe I liked research so much because I knew I was going to, because I knew I had direction, and I knew that it was going to work because this brilliant man told me it was working. By God, if it didn't, it took me a year and a half to do it. But, maybe you're right. I never thought of it like that before.
I don't know. Just throwing out questions. Well, so coming back to college, nonetheless, you didn't go through the usual crap that an awful lot of freshmen go through, who just go out of their mind, who behave a little bit like that passage which I read. I mean, maybe you went through some of it, and I'm not asking you to bare your soul to tell me how many binges you went on, but the first question is, did you avoid all that? And the second question is, if so, how?
I avoided it in the extent that I didn't do it every night. I mean, studies always have come first. But I realized there's a point when you just can, when like study, I realized there's a point that you can study too much, and it's actually detrimental to study any further. I have a friend who's a classic case in point in that. She won't stop studying. But the weekends were somewhat sacred. I mean, Friday nights, I would never do anything, and usually Saturday nights on my freshman year, I never did it. I just went out and I drank with the guys, and we got out of hand once in a while. And because it's important that you have this release valve and you go out and just screw around and do stupid, yeah. stupid kid things. Because if you don't, you're just going to get pent up and lose your mind, I think. So even my senior year, I mean, Friday nights, go out and do something. Saturday nights, go out and do something. But if it came down to the point where I had so much work to do that I couldn't go out maybe a week or 2 weeks in a row, I wouldn't do it, knowing the fact that 3 weeks later I could really let my steam out and go out and have a good time. That's always important to me. I have to go out and have a good time.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, what's happening to most of these kids who come to college, go absolutely crazy, and what? You had it under control. I mean, you balanced it in measure with your academics. You were saying, sure, I'll study hard, but give me a few day or so a week so I can go off and go out and blow off steam.
Right.
But there are a lot of others who go to a far greater extreme.
Oh, tell me about it.
Now, how do you explain that? What is it? Is it because they've had no discipline in the first 16 years of their life? They haven't studied at all? Is it because they're escaping their parents for the first time? What the hell's going on?
I'd say it's any one thing I think is wrong. I don't have the answers, but from what I've seen, partly it's they're not disciplined. I mean, a lot of it's the fact they're away from home for the first time and they can do a lot of things they never were able to do. I think most parents these days are just too strict with their kids. I was lucky. I had parents.
Did you say too strict?
Too strict. They're too strict with it. When you take a kid and you sit there and say you can't do this, they're gonna do it. You tell them you can't do this, they're gonna do it just to piss you off. I was a kid. My sister went through a phase. My mom said you can't do this, and damn it, even if she didn't want to do it beforehand, she went out and did it, because they're kids. And if you're too strict with a kid, they're just gonna rebel against you. And when they first get that chance to go away from home and just do anything they want, a lot of them get out of hand. But overall, I mean, I think society itself, like East Lansing in particular, I mean, there is a problem at state, but I think it's not as big as they see it as. I mean, hell, didn't they do this once as kids? It's part of the American rite of passage to do this in college. Granted, it gets out of hand sometimes, but I wouldn't label it necessarily a problem. I mean, there are a couple problem kids, but overall, it's a problem. If it's anything, I would say it's more society's fault than anything, just the way they're brought up.
So in a way, you're saying that it is possibly a healthy thing to go through.
It is. You have to, I think. You have to go and blow steam and learn what it's like to be on your own. Hopefully, in the lesson you'll learn, it's not that fun, and you should be more careful and whatnot. But most of at the freshman age in college are still rebellious. They're still kids. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they're still high school people, and you tell them to do something, they're going to do it.
Do you know anything about the Japanese system of education? They have enormous emphasis on working incredibly hard for the first 12 years, then they go to hell in college.
Exactly. That's where America catches up. If you were to take your average Japanese high school student and your American high school student, Japanese high school student's going to, he's going to wipe them out and everything there is. But doesn't Japan have a high rate of suicide in college? Just because they've been through 12 years of just, I read an article about it once in Smithsonian, just an intense school system where everything is so damn competitive. There's always this feeling that urges people on to do better and better and better, that when, by the time they get to college, to ask them to do any more of it is futile. Because a lot of them are committing suicide as it is already. You just can't ask that much of a person, even if they are Japanese.
Doesn't their system produce somebody that fits into a corporate world more efficiently, though? If you train from a very young age someone to adhere to the norms, isn't he going to have an easier time when he steps out into the corporate world?
I assume, but is that necessarily better? Is that a better thing to do? I hate to watch these commercials on television where you get these people saying, "Look at our kids. Look at the Korean kids. Look what our kids can do, and look how better the Korean kids can do it. We need computers." It's like computers are the panacea to our educational system, where money is. Whereas, I mean, granted, they might be better, but look at the way the society is. You can't expect American kids to act like Korean kids. Because it's different. And to say any one system is better than another is just an individual opinion.
Don't you think, though, that things have deteriorated too much when you have kids graduating from high school who cannot read or write?
Sure.
There are a lot of those.
I'm not saying that American education system is great or anything. It's probably as bad as they say it is, if not worse. I don't know if you've ever seen the Saturday Night Live. One time they had this game show, and they had all these famous, like William F. Buckley on it. And it was this quiz show, and they would ask these simple questions, and who wrote Ulysses? And someone would say James Joyce. No, I'm sorry, that's wrong. William Shakespeare wrote it. What? They're looking around, and it was, and the answers were based on a survey of American high school students. I don't know why I said that. That was funny, but
yeah, it is. I mean, it's tragic.
And the thing is, it's true. You're always reading these surveys about how they can't pick out the author of, you know, Raisin in the Sun and whatnot. But there is a problem, and what is the problem? I mean, I don't know what it is. I'm sure there are a lot of things. And to think we can just blindly solve it with money, I think is wrong. We need a basic restructuring of parts of our society as far as kids go. I mean, drugs probably play a big part of it. I think older America has to better understand what it's like to be a kid. It's beyond me how these parents and older people can deprecate kids so badly when they were once kids themselves, and they must have done the same thing. Don't they understand it? It's like somewhere like in ages of like 25 and up, they seem to lose idea of what it's like to be a kid and what you do, and they don't understand it, and they just do things that are so, you know, they just try to annoy kids that the kids just rebel against it. I mean,
you think the temptations are greater for kids now? I mean, when I was a kid, the worst thing you could do was smoke a cigarette or maybe have a can of beer. Compare that to the
what you can do these days. Exactly. I don't know. It's hard to say. Maybe. I mean, who's to say that when you grew up, you know, marijuana wasn't available. Maybe it was available, not as readily as it is now. And to blame it all on that, I think, is wrong, because I think we should be able to raise a society that sees that this stuff is wrong. And obviously we're not doing it correct right now, because it's still a big problem. But to legalize it might ease some of the pain. I think legalizing it wouldn't be a bad idea, truthfully.
Of course, legalizing alcohol didn't solve the alcohol problem, did it?
No, we'll always have it. I mean, man will always have his drug. You can't take it away. We have to have our escape from reality, I guess. I don't know what it is.
I'm going to give you a transcript of this. You may use it for sidewall insulation, or you may actually pick it up and read it 10 years from now. What would you like to read in that? There you are. I'm asking really for you to project yourself into the future 10 years and to look back on your life. I mean, what
do you think I'll see?
Yeah, what do you think you'll see? What do you think your reaction will be? What do you think
hopefully,
you'll see?
Hopefully, ideally, I'd like to say, wow, here's a very together 22-year-old who knew what was going on. You know, in hindsight. But what I'll see? Yeah, you know, you tell me. I don't know. 10 years away is a long... I mean, who knows? I could be a bum on the streets in 10 years. I could be the captain of my own sub in 10 years. 10 years is too far away to project what I think. I'd like to see me as a 32-year-old reading this going, wow, he was sort of on the right track, yet he was still young and hopefully idealistic about things, maybe not. He didn't know what was going on. I don't know. Wait to find out. I'm sure I'll get a chuckle out of it.
How are you gonna factor in things like a family and children and all this?
And as far as
just assuming that you do choose the Navy, which is the ultimate in adrenaline-pumping, ego-trips, whatever, you know. There you are. You're away for 4 months.
I know. I don't know. Well, I mean, right now it's no big deal because, hell, I don't even have a girlfriend right now. I mean, getting married is the farthest thing from my mind. But I have thought about it if I were to get married. I don't know. Well, some things you have to worry about when it actually gets there.
I remember you had a nice-looking girlfriend over at one, I think it was your graduation party. At least she looked nice in a bathing suit anyway. I may be married, but I'm not dead, so.
Probably did.
Yeah, I don't know who that was. But you probably haven't had too much time for her. If you've been working as hard as you say you have in school.
I haven't had that many girlfriends in college. Yeah. Probably because I work a lot. Probably because there aren't many women in chemistry. And the number of girlfriends you have, I think, is a direct function of how many are in your immediate environment. Where you work, what you do, and I didn't have many. Never money in chemistry.
Well, the current juggling act of being married to someone who places an equal importance on her vocation as you do on yours almost dooms a certain number of marriages, doesn't it?
I guess. Well, you've heard of the DINKs, I think they call it, double income, no kids.
Yeah.
You know, they have to have like set up, you know, times just to have sex and whatnot. I don't know if I wouldn't like that. You know, if my wife has a vocation that she really enjoys, great. I mean, I guess it wouldn't work out if I was in the Navy and I was very vocation oriented, because, you know, as in the Navy, I'll be moving around all over the place, because Navy doesn't like keep you anywhere for more than 3 years.
Of course, being a dink is probably better than being an oink. You know what an oink is?
No, I'm not sure.
One income nasty kids.
I never heard that one. Yeah. I'm sure.
Heard that for the first time the other day. Some guy just coined it. So what is it that we're leaving out? I mean, we can just have a general bull session here, or we can focus in on something that you would really like to put on tape. We've covered a lot of college material here.
It doesn't seem like we have been. Your boss.
Well, tell me, let's go back to, what about the general quality of the professors that you had at U of M? Good, bad, and different?
Yeah, I think I had some of, I had some from the whole spectrum. At least I thought I did. Most of my professors, I thought, were just brilliant men. I mean, I had one professor who's been talked about as getting a Nobel Prize. As much as I hated him, I had to respect him. I didn't like him very much. But I thought I had professors that were bad.
Why didn't you like him? Or why didn't you respect him? Excuse me.
I didn't. Oh, I respect him. It's just that he's got a mean streak in him, and he doesn't have very much patience for people who don't understand certain things. And this was in my thermodynamics class, and that's hard enough when you first take it. But I respect him. He's a brilliant man.
Would he tend to be a little bit sadistic?
I tell you, when I was taking his class, I thought he sure was. But in the end, it was good for you, because he forced you to do things you never would have done. I mean, I liked him because his class was a challenge, and he made you learn things that you might have thought were useless and esoteric, but in the end, you were a better person for it. I don't mind being beaten out of my classes as far as academics goes. That's another problem with America, if I might throw that on this tape. American kids don't want to be, they don't like being challenged, I don't think. Some do, but for the most part, if you sit there and you give a person a class an extra problem in, say, organic chemistry, they're going to go, oh, I can't go out and do this now, I got to do this problem. Whereas I think it's too bad. They should go, wow, maybe I might learn something new and extraordinary from this problem, and it'll better me.
Well, you're saying American kids. Do you think this is a cultural thing? Because they haven't...
I say American kids because that's all I've ever known. I've never been to a foreign country, save Canada or Mexico, for a day or two.
Do you think that these are the ones who have not developed any discipline in high school?
I think everywhere. I mean, to a certain extent, I'm guilty of it. You know, when I got something going on that, you know, I don't feel like doing my work, but... I think we need to be more challenged. I think we need another war. I'm just kidding.
Well, on a philosophic level, maybe man is inherently lazy.
I think so. It seems like it to me. I mean.
So what ultimately makes you happy then?
Makes me happy? Material things.
Learning something?
Learning things. I like reading. I like learning things. I get the most perverse little pleasure of learning the little most insignificant facts and just saving it and watching Jeopardy and hoping it'll pop up there someday.
But by and large, the professors you had at the university were
good.
Pretty good.
No, I've never had a class on tape. I've never had a TV class, as they do at State, which I think is just terrible. How can they call themselves a university? Have classes where you go in this huge lecture hall and watch it on television. How can you have freshman chemistry on tape recorder? Go in there, get your classes four tapes, and have a workbook. That's not education. You have to have interaction between your professor and your student at a chalkboard, writing things down. I even hate professors who use a little projectors. That's not the way you teach. It's on a chalkboard with chalk. In a sense, I'm a traditionalist. And I'm a traditionalist when it comes to education. You need a professor. You need chalkboards. You can't have classes with 300 people. And I had a couple classes that had like 300 people in them, and they were all introductory level classes. But past your sophomore year, you don't see much of anything like that at the University of Michigan. I mean, you might have 50 or 60 kids, which is still rather large, but Michigan State just takes things too far. I mean, I think that's part of the problem. Now, wasn't it true like a while ago they were thinking of getting rid of the humanities department and funding the football team or something like that?
I don't know whether there was that direct connection. They were thinking of doing something to the humanities.
Yeah, like getting rid of it. And at the same time, they were building the indoor football facility.
Yeah.
I mean, that's bad.
Well, they're trying desperately to beat U of M.
Well, that shouldn't matter.
I know what you're saying. It's pathetic.
And you have people paying thousands of dollars a year to sign your kids to this. You might as well just go to the community college.
The basic attitude, though, of students that you had contact with at U of M, Did they regard U of M as essentially a trade school? I'll concentrate in engineering. I'll graduate as an engineer. I'll stick to that field, and when I graduate, I'll hopefully step into a $35,000 a year job or whatever. Or were they?
That's the way the engineers are.
Yeah,
all of them are. I've never met one that wasn't like that. Of course, I think that's just the engineering mentality too. But as far as LSNA people, as far as literature, science, and the arts goes, I found very few people who were very focused. They were just walking around, well, I think I might major in this. But in reality, I think sometimes Americans are too damn practical. I mean, people think, well, what can you do with an English major? And really, the only thing you can maybe teach with it, but in reality, when a person goes to a job, they learn most of the stuff on that job. I mean, an English major or a psychology major or a sociology major can do just about anything. You know, it's just people think, well, if you're going to be a psychology major, then you're going to be a psychologist. If you're going to be a sociology major, then you have to be a sociologist. They get this one-to-one correspondence going where you have to do these things, and they think and that's why I think there's such a bad image of like liberal arts majors. Because God, what can you do with an English major? You can do a whole hell of a lot with one, I think. Exactly what, I'm not sure, but now you don't necessarily have to teach English, which most people think you can do. That's what most of the engineers think you have to do with an English major. But overall, most students aren't focused, which is bad, and it's good. I mean, it's good to go through maybe first 2 years at college not very focused, but after a while, it does begin to hurt you.
So you really consider yourself in the minority in the sense that you ultimately ended up being much more focused than many of your
fellow students.
I was
lucky as far as things go. I've never changed my major. I never really declared history or philosophy. I was thinking of doing it. But I've never changed my major once. I've had friends who've done it 4 times.
And you don't regret that?
Not at all. Not yet. I hope I don't.
No regrets?
Not yet whatsoever. In that sense, I'm a very lucky person. I see that.
Yeah. How about Andrea? What's she going to do?
She's an English major, she wants to go to law school. Kind of lawyers as it is, but you know what? My sister's kind of person. She's focused as well, and no matter what she does, she'll succeed at. It might not be a lawyer or an English teacher, but she'll find something, a job that she'll love, and she'll just be herself. She's great. She'll do fine. I'm not worried about her.
Any last parting words?
No, not really.
For the tape? For
it runs out
something to assure your immortality?
No,